And good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in beautiful Portland, Oregon, USA, and online at kboo.fm. My name is Andrew Geller, and in the next hour, we're going to be looking at the recent federal indictments against many environmental and animal liberation activists for a variety of charges. And we'll be looking at that with attorney Lauren Regan, who directs the Civil Liberties Defense Center down in Eugene. And then in the second half of the hour, Ward Churchill, author, activist, and professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, will join us to place these indictments in the context of a long history of state infiltration and disruption of radical activist movements. And former Earth First Journal editor Jim Flynn will also be joining at that time to talk about security culture. But now we're going to get to the actual indictments. As I mentioned, Lauren Regan is an attorney practicing down in Eugene, and she runs the Civil Liberties Defense Center, and I am very pleased to have you on the program. Good morning to you, Lauren.
Good morning. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, my pleasure. Now, just at the front end, could you please describe for the listeners your role or lack of role in actually dealing with these indictments and why it is that you are speaking about them, just so people know where you're coming from on this?
Okay. Well, I am an attorney in Eugene, and I do a lot of activist defense and activist support work. And about 2 years ago, when the first round of grand juries hit Eugene regarding what was generically called the Romania investigations at that time, I represented a grand jury witness that had been subpoenaed. When this new round of grand jury subpoenas were issued and then subsequently the indictments, it was kind of too early for me to take on a role in the cases without worrying about attorney conflict rules. So we decided that with the Civil Liberties Defense Center, we would kind of offer general support to all of the defendants in helping them find adequate representation. We reached out to the families and key support people of the people that were indicted to offer explanations of the legal process and to put them in touch with attorneys and other sources of information that they needed. And we've also kind of taken a role in explaining the process and, you know, the underlying implications of these investigations to the public and the media.
Okay, great. Thank you. It's the January 20th, 2006 indictment that is the only pending legal action at this point against 11 people. But I want to have you explain just a little bit what happened between, I guess, about December 7th and January 20th. A whole bunch of people were indicted separately, and then that all got combined to January 20th. Can you just explain how things went from all these different separate grand juries and indictments in December to one single federal indictment late in January? And then we'll look at the indictment itself.
Sure. The federal government, the U.S. Attorney's Office, has a lot of discretion on how they bring about criminal charges against folks. And so back in November and December, based upon information provided by a single informant, the federal government finally had enough information, they felt, to begin issuing subpoenas and indictments for the arrest of certain people that had been informed upon by this person. And they began filing individual indictments against individual people who were involved in a variety of different arsons. For instance, there is a woman, Josephine Sunshine Overraker, who still has not been apprehended, but she was one of the early people that was that were indicted on a couple different arson charges in her own name as an individual case. And then at some point, through coordination of multiple federal prosecutor offices, they decided that instead of going at each one of these things on an individual basis, that they were, and I'm sure that this was not something that, was kind of a light bulb going off in the night. I'm sure that this was, you know, something that they had anticipated doing. They elected to combine all of the incidents and all of the defendants together under one indictment because they have now charged two additional counts of conspiracy. There's a conspiracy to commit arson charge, and then there's a conspiracy destroy...
it was like federal property, right?
Well, it was like electronic devices or something like that. Let me tell you.
Did that have to relate to the cell phone tower been referenced?
Yeah, it was related to the Bonneville Power Administration Tower. And so those two conspiracy counts basically allege that two or more people planned and... you know, actually participated in the commission of a crime. That's the generic definition of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And so it was the second count was conspiracy to commit arson and destruction of an energy facility. And so when they charged those two conspiracy counts, they are basically alleging that all of these people were working as this vast network and that, you know, one shoe knew what the other shoe was doing type of thing, which, you know, we'll see whether that, you know, is provable beyond a reasonable doubt. But that was basically what happened. And so now at this point, there is only one case number. Like you mentioned, there are 11 defendants at this time. The federal government is certainly indicating that there are more to come. And... there are 65 counts in this indictment, which sounds kind of chilling, but when you take a closer look at the actual indictment, 43 out of 65 of those counts are actually counts of individual vehicles that were allegedly burned during these arsons. So only 22 of the counts are actual crimes. The rest of them are basically... laying out each individual license plate number of each individual car that may have, you know, been burned or had smoke damage or whatever.
Now, in the coverage of these indictments, clear back to December and stretching way back into the 90s, and this is really where Ward, Jim, and I will go more, but to the extent it's relevant for talking about the indictments, we should mention it. The term... eco-terrorism, eco-terrorist, et cetera, along those lines, has been used over and over and over again, much to the delight, I'm sure, of Ron Arnold from the Center of Defense for Free Enterprise, who basically coined the term at least a couple decades ago, and him and his buddies have been working real hard to get that concept into people's heads about environmental and animal liberation activists. In this indictment, and in the other indictments going back 6 weeks before January 20, did the term terrorism appear in any of the indictments in the context of actual charges laid?
Well, the term terrorism doesn't really appear in the indictments themselves. Mm-hmm. This is a sensationalist term, you know, that's coming from a place of ignorance. I think, you know, most of us know that terrorism is terrorism, which means a threat or harm to human life, mm-hmm. where what we're dealing with in these circumstances is vandalism. No one was ever harmed. There was never any intention to harm any form of life, based on these acts, as my understanding. And, you know, it's basically been a term that has been used for media hype more than factual bases. And as far as, you know, where this term is coming from, there are some federal sentencing enhancements that are being bandied about that have to do with the term domestic terrorism, which is being defined loosely as if someone commits a crime but has a political motivation for doing so instead of, like, being, you know, a selfish reason or a drug-induced reason, you will get extreme enhanced punishment for that crime.
Right.
So, you know, if someone kills someone because they're crazy or they've cheated on their wife or some sort of selfish reason, not the crazy as a selfish reason, but, you know, drug addicted or whatever, you know, they might get, let's say, 10 years. But if that same person killed another human and then said that the reason was based on some political belief, you know, they would get 30 years to life for that same murder. So it's definitely something that we're looking at as far as, you know, whether, I mean, when you look historically, and I'm sure Ward will talk about this more, but, you know, if you look historically at our country, you know, acts like the Boston Tea Party were cases that if they happened today would be prosecuted under these domestic terrorism laws. Because they were done for political reasons and they caused economic property damage, which is basically what's being alleged in these cases.
And there is a legal definition of both international terrorism as a crime and newly, in the past few years, domestic terrorism. The People Rise Up website will have links to those. If you want to check it out ahead of time, you go to the U.S. Code, Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 113B, Section 2331 has those definitions only. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland, Oregon. Lauren Regan is my guest for this part of the program. She's the executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center down in Eugene, Oregon. And you can find out more about them online at www.cldc.org. And there's links there related to the topic we're discussing, which is the recent indictments of environmental and animal liberation activists for a series of arsons and other acts. So the grand jury process is where this came out of. And my understanding, having never gone through one but studied them some, is that the prosecution is able to present all the evidence they have to try and convince the grand jury to level an indictment. And these are sealed processes. Indictments can be unsealed, but that doesn't reveal what the evidence is presented. Is that correct?
Right. The grand jury process itself is a secret process. And historically, it was made secret to protect the reputation of the person being accused. So the original reason for grand juries being secret was so that if someone was wrongfully accused of a crime, the whole town wouldn't have heard about it. And of course, you know, that historical reasoning has certainly been bastardized over time now, where now the process is secret to protect snitches and witnesses and federal investigation type of things. They are held in secret. The only person that is allowed into the grand jury room other than the prosecutor and the grand jurors is the witness themselves. Their attorney has to stand out in the hall, basically. And only the prosecution provides evidence or testimony to the grand jurors. You know, the defendant or the accused person does not get to present any evidence. You do not have a normal right to refuse to testify unless you have some very specific defense, you know, under the Fifth Amendment or something like that. But it's, you know, a kind of unusual process in that citizens are compelled to testify against their will. The proceedings are recorded, and after someone is indicted, there is a process by which a defense attorney can actually get the transcripts of a grand jury proceeding, but that's a fairly rare occurrence.
Okay.
And the final outcome is that the grand jurors vote on whether they believe they have been presented enough information in order to issue an indictment. And, you know, there's lots of historical sayings that a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich because if you're only told one side of the story and you're told that your job today is to indict people, very few citizens are going to have the knowledge or wherewithal to actually critically analyze the information being presented to them and actually make judgments based on, you know, how you would hope that our community would charge people with crimes.
So now back to this actual January 20th indictment. There's 11 folks charged. Three of them have not yet been apprehended and are believed to still be outside of the country. Of the eight people, well, I should mention, Initially, it was 12 people who were indicted.
Mm-hmm.
One man was found dead in his cell, and the circumstances around that are unclear. So there were 12 indictees. Originally, there are 11 in the January 20th. 8 of the 11 have been in custody, and 6 of those 8 have been released.
There's more than that.
Okay.
Right now, Chelsea Gerlach and Darren Thurston both remain in custody.
Okay.
As well as Stan Meyerhoff and Kevin Tubbs, both who have apparently become informants but are still defendants and are still in custody.
Okay. And now, the issue that I'm glad you brought up in your discussion of grand jury is the process of using snitches and informants, sometimes with promises of benefit later on, I guess always with promises of benefit. Sometimes the benefits accrue, and sometimes I imagine they don't. My understanding is that the case against these folks in large part is based on snitches and informants. Is that a fair characterization from what you know?
Well, I would say that it's really early in the process right now. You know, hardly any discovery has been turned over to the defendants yet. So it's kind of premature to make kind of a blanket statement like that.
Okay.
But what we do know is that all of the initial indictments and information that was provided to the government was not done as a result of their investigation, but was as a result of a single informant who, you know, no one really fully understands how he got into their clutches, so to speak, and why he, you know, began, you know, cooperating with mm-hmm. the government. But we do know that he has been offered large benefits, and we do know that he was threatened with, you know, life in prison, that many of the people that have become cooperating witnesses were threatened with spending the rest of their life in prison. You know, we heard in court the U.S. attorney indicating for several of the defendants that they were looking at life plus 335 years. And so, you know, although perhaps ethically people, you know, really have really struggle with the issue of cooperating witnesses, I think everyone can kind of be cognizant of the fact that a threat of life plus 335 years can spin a person's head,
mm-hmm.
especially when they're in custody. So that basically is what's going on. And, you know, as one person begins informing, it's kind of, slippery slope.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the classic prisoner's dilemma on a larger scale than, I guess, just 3 or 4 people, which I guess was the original model.
Right.
Because, I mean, to a large extent, the police are trained in how to extract information from you.
Right.
And there's no, you know, they don't have to tell the truth in the context of questioning you.
Right. And they also have a lot extensive training on picking their victims well.
Hmm.
And so, you know, if they think someone is, you know, a very strong person and, it, you know, very principled, they may not pick that person as a target, but may instead go for people that potentially have more of an Achilles heel apparent. And, I mean, at least in the case of Stan Meyerhoff, it seems that they, you know, pushed his buttons, you know, with a lot of expertise and quickly gained his cooperation as well.
Now, I've been thinking about, should I mention all the people's names? I'm not going to list everybody's names because people can find out more about this online. And it's all listed there. The indictment itself is at the Center for Civil Liberties, the Civil Liberties Defense Center's website.
Uh-huh.
So indictments have happened. It appears as though some people are cooperating. Some people have not yet been apprehended. Trial dates have been, it doesn't seem like trial dates as such have been set. There's a kind of window in which it's been talked about these cases going to trial of late October and November of this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, the trial date has been set for October 31st, and it's anticipated to be a five-week jury trial.
Okay.
I think the confusion probably comes from the fact that very often in federal prosecutions of this nature, postponements are almost inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
It really seems like the defense attorneys are going to work their butts off to make sure that trial does happen on that first set date, especially because there are defendants that may very well remain in custody until that date. You know, one of the defendants is a Canadian citizen, and so he will not be able to be released because of INS restrictions on him. So we know at least one person is going to be remaining in custody until his trial date. And so I think that the defense attorneys are going to make every attempt possible to make sure that the trial goes on October 31st.
So between now and then, for folks who are interested in not only learning more, but playing some sort of active support role, what would you recommend folks do to engage themselves if they would like to in this process?
Well, I think, you know, if you're asking me what can they do to support an individual defendant, I think most of them have their own websites and their own, you know, little support teams that would be best able to coordinate new volunteers or to plug people in. I know that there are a couple groups in Portland that have been forming around grand jury activism and these cases. I think one is called the Northwest Grand Jury Project. I know that Civil Liberties Defense Center is doing a road show in a couple weeks, and we are actually doing two shows in Portland. And there have been a couple groups that have kind of stepped forward to help us put those shows on. I think, I can't remember the name of it right this second, Portland Legal Defense Team, I think is the name of it, but I may be incorrect on that.
Well, we'll make sure we get announcements about those Portland events here on Tekebu.
Yeah, and I mean, those would be first steps, I think, in plugging yourself in. You know, obviously, people can, you know, send monetary donations to those folks, but I think there's also a need for people who are doing you know, activism as their day-to-day life. You know, I think that all of the defendants would agree that the last thing anyone wants is for, you know, that effective work that people were doing to slow down. So, you know, people who are doing timber sale monitoring and who, you know, have been doing public work, you know, all along, you know, our hope is that that work is certainly going to continue and continue to be effective. So I think the other thing, in addition on focusing a lot of energy on this current crisis, which it certainly is, you know, a very, very serious situation, I don't think that people would want everyone's energy to be sucked toward prisoner support and these cases. I think people need to remember to continue doing all of the other good work that they're doing, in addition to being aware of what is going on to their community and friends and loved ones and, you know, and things of that nature. Going to the court appearances, you know, as long as you're dressed respectfully to the court, you know, certainly the defendants, you know, love seeing friendly faces in the audience. They don't get very many visitors at all right now, so, you know, that's always a good thing. And writing letters to them, because obviously, especially for the folks that are still in custody, that's sometimes their only mode of support that they can see and actually participate in. So our website and many other websites have all of the contact information for all of the defendants to be written to.
Yeah, and I'll link to those separately as well. We've got just a couple of minutes left here, and I want to ask you something that will sort of segue into what we're going to talk about with Ward Churchill in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's been revealed recently, actually just after those initial December indictments came down, not only is the National Security Agency under the direct order of George W. Bush illegally spying domestically, but it's been revealed through Freedom of Information Act requests from the American Civil Liberties Union that, in fact, the FBI has been continuing political monitoring of activist organizations where, you know, they claim there's evidence or possibility of criminal acts, but, in fact, very little has been shown in that way. So given this revelation that the FBI has been caught yet again spying domestically on activists, and that statute of limitations were running out on some of these crimes, I'm curious how you think those things played into these indictments.
Well, I think I think those things may have played into the indictments, but I think another facet that we didn't really touch on is, you know, about a year and a half ago, the FBI declared the ELF as their number one priority for domestic terrorist threats.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of making that announcement, just like when they made the announcement that they were going to go find WMDs, you know, in the U.S. government, they were going to make arrests, and they were going to prove, you know, their effectiveness in, you know, coming through with what they said they were going to do. And so, you know, just like we went to war to prove that WMDs existed, you know, we now have all of these indictments so that the FBI can say that they have made their ELF arrests, and, you know, don't we all feel safer now? So I think that there are a lot of factors that went into this. Certainly politics are playing a huge role. The fact that Alberto Gonzalez took time out of his day to make a press conference and do a bunch of sensationalist pretrial publicity about these cases when, you know, in the very same month, one of the Oklahoma City bombers was about to be released from jail, that killed, you know, all these people, or the fact that Aberhoff, you know, is being prosecuted for peddling billions of dollars in legislative influence, and Enron is in trial this month. I mean, there's certainly, you know, they're hoping that this is a lovely sensationalist distraction mm-hmm. from all of the crap that is currently being ladled upon this administration. And I think that, you know, this is a little safe diversion for them that they hope, you know, if they focus all this media attention to it, the American public will forget about the real issues that are going on. You know, I mean, the same, you know, when Gonzalez did that press conference, the media basically responded by asking him about Bin Laden, because the Bin Laden tape had just been played like the day before, and the media was like, why are we here talking about, you know, these people who burned a horse corral? We want to know about Bin Laden and some of these global terrorist threats you keep talking about.
Right.
So hopefully people will be able to see through that veneer and, you know, realize that these cases are really about property damage and vandalism. No one's saying that they are not crimes, but many of these people were teenagers at the time that these acts were committed. They keep touting that this is over $100 million over 10 years, you know, by half a dozen kids. And when you compare that to the billions and billions of dollars that have been stolen by people who have been government employees, or, you know, working within the legislative branch of government, it really kind of makes you wonder, you know, what exactly is going on here.
Yeah, totally pales in comparison. I want to let you know that I will be discussing the inclusion on the Department of Homeland Security domestic terrorism list of who's there and who's not coming up. But I want to thank you very much for being on the program this morning.
Yeah,
Lauren Regan is an attorney and executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center down in Eugene, Oregon. And again, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, bye-bye.
I will be back in just a moment here with Ward Churchill and Jim Flynn. Got a little piece of music here from Holly Tannen.
I dreamed I saw J. Edgar Hoover live as you or me. But Jay, I said, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he. I never died, said he. For 40 years, by fear and greed, you ruled the FBI. But now we've taken back our rights, says he. I did not die, says he. I did not die. Where their phones are tapped and lists are kept and documents are shred, where statesmen and reporters lie, it's there you'll find Jed. It's there you'll find Jed, where poor folks fear to speak their mind and live apart in dread, where crimes are blamed on innocence, it's there you'll find Jed. It's there you'll find Jed. And standing there as fat as life, with beady little eyes. So if you think I'm dead, he says, just try to organize. Just try to organize.
A little bit of music there from Holly Tannen. I Dreamed I Saw J. Edgar Hoover, based on I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill, the old wobbly tune. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland, Oregon, USA, online at kboo.fm. We've been discussing the recent indictment of 11 environmental and animal rights activists for a variety of charges. First half, we spoke with Lauren Regan, executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center down in Eugene, Oregon. And now in this half of the hour, I am going to shift gears and talk to some folks who will help provide historical context for the continuation state infiltration of radical activist movements, as well as some security tips for those of you who may have done things that might be illegal but don't want anyone to be able to find out about them. So my two guests for this portion of the program are Ward Churchill. He is a longtime activist, author, and he's a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's written over 20 books, hundreds of essays, and the books include the COINTELPRO Papers, documents from the FBI's secret war against domestic dissent with Jim Vanderwall. That came out a whole 15 years ago. It's kind of amazing. Other books include, on the topic, Draconian Measures, the History of FBI Political Repression, To Disrupt, Discredit, and Destroy, the FBI's Secret War Against the Black Panther Party, and many, many other books. And it is my pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves, Ward.
Well, good to be here.
And also we have Jim Flynn, who is a longtime activist with Earth First and other movements. He's also a former longtime editor of the Earth First Journal during the 1990s. And welcome to you, Jim.
Thanks, Andrew, and thanks for having this program.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm going to put Jim in the background for just a little bit here and start off talking to Ward more about some historical context, and then we'll kind of shift gears and focus more on the security angle of things. Now, Ward, you've studied this for quite some time, and COINTELPRO papers are viewed widely as sort of a reference document for a lot of folks interested in this. Can you tell me what you have followed in terms of these recent indictments, and in hearing about them, what did it make you think of in terms of the other work that you've done along these lines?
Well, I would like to make first one clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Briefly, Draconian Measures never came out.
Okay.
That's a work in progress. It was announced prematurely by a publisher. People should not go on Amazon and try to order the thing because they won't get it and it'll just be frustrating.
Okay, it says out of print. Okay, so forget that book.
Yeah, do forget that book. For the moment. The question really comes down to how far back you'd like to take it, because police and intelligence agencies or their private sector surrogates have been engaged in infiltrative activities virtually forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can go back. I'm sitting here in Colorado, so we could go back to the United Mine Workers and IWW campaigns of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. You have a guy named Harry Orchard, who was apparently a Pinkerton plant, running around conducting bombing activities to create a sort of confirmation of the public image that was being projected of the union organizers at the time. The union people were not actually doing this. There was a rhetorical posture that was presented in the press as leading to concrete acts of what they called anarchy that were clear and present danger to the public well-being, and then you have this provocateur who was actually working for the Pinkertons running around in the midst setting bombs at mine facilities. The Orchard case is fairly prominent. You have a very similar case with the Molly Maguires out in the Pennsylvania coal fields back in the late 19th century, where you had a provocateur who did concrete acts which contributed to the creation of the image, the consolidation of the image in the public consciousness of the Mollies as being this violence-prone public menace sort of organization, and that justified, create the pretext for the virtual liquidation of the Molly leadership. They were hanged en masse, and on and on and on, up into the 1960s, you know, we have infiltrators that were right close to Marcus Garvey back during World War One. We have infiltrators into the Communist Party. We have infiltrators into the SWP, most of them advocating criminal activity which would not have otherwise been undertaken by the organizations in question, up into the 1960s when you got some very famous cases, one involving a guy by the name, he was called Tommy the Traveler, who worked for the New York Red Squad in combination with the FBI, went from campus to campuses impersonating a militant SDS organizer and convinced people to engage in symbolic acts of the sort that would be, oh, bombing ROTC buildings, firebombing them and so forth. Got a lot of legitimate activists arrested on criminal charges having to do with violence against the state of a very ill-considered sort, and consolidated this image of the new left in the public mind in such a way as other forms of repression were then justified in eroded support for the anti-war movement and so forth. And then you have another case in Los Angeles that about the same time, an infiltrator from the FBI into the Black Panther Party by the name of D'Arthur Perry, codenamed Othello, who was responsible for a number of bombings in the Los Angeles area at the time. The conclusion I draw from that is things are not necessarily as they appear. This is not to make a tactical argument one way or the other on the propriety of bombing or bombing specific targets or engaging in other kinds of property destruction and sabotage and so forth. What it is to say is that simply because people are charged with particular offenses does not mean, A, that they committed them, and B, that there's not direct state involvement orchestrating that of which they're accused.
And even more recently than that, and in specific to the environmental activist community, there was a lot of infiltration when Earth First came on the scene in the early 1980s. Maybe not so much infiltration at the front end, but a few years in, fairly famous cases of folks down in Arizona in the late 80s.
Dave Foreman and those guys.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and Peg Millett. And then shortly thereafter, the folks in Northern California, the Redwood Summer Campaign with the bombing of Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. And again, you know, environmentalists were investigated. A real search for the actual perpetrator of the crime has never been done. And the
And there's an apparent infiltrator involved in the Berry Cherney case as well, by the name of Irv Sutley.
Yep.
And that was hotly contested at the time I surfaced that, but was ultimately, to all intents and purposes, as I understand it, proven to be correct on the basis of DNA analysis during the Cherney. Well, it ended up being a Cherney suit because Judy Berry had died.
Right.
But at trial, it was established that Sutley had been, in fact, acting in a provocateur capacity, the full extent of which is not known.
Now, the FBI, it was recently revealed, again, has in fact been caught spying domestically on political activist organizations. And in a New York Times article, December 20th, it notes that charges that, quote, the government had improperly blurred the line between terrorism and acts of civil disobedience and lawful protest, end quote, surface yet again. Can you talk a little bit about that intentional blurring and somewhat how it's you know, there's kind of the old sort of joke, sort of not joke. The one offering the explosives is always the agent.
Well, yeah, it's one of those that bears an unfortunate degree of truth, but is not always true. I mean, this is very complicated stuff,
yeah.
Logically and tactically in certain ways, because they create the impression that if you go beyond symbolic protests, petition drives, state-approved activities, or state-sanctioned activities, that somehow or another you have to be a provocateur, and of course that puts you in a box of ineffectuality, and that's the box that by and large the so-called opposition in this country finds itself. Really interestingly, it takes that ineffectuality of symbolic protest and turns that into a virtue and a position of moral purity. You obviously have to step out of the box. You have to engage in activity not sanctioned by the state if you're to transform the functioning of state power. Okay, question is how to go about doing that, and that leads to your question on activist security. Okay, and there are no perfect answers to that, but the short version, the most effective means that anybody has ever found, to my knowledge, is to function on the basis of long-term affinity groups. People you know well, you've spent years with, okay, you know on that basis, or have reason to believe you know on that basis at least, that these are trustworthy people. They are not people pretending to be something that they are not. And you can engage in action that seemed to make sense. I advise being rather well considered in terms of effect and cost-benefit analysis of whatever you do, legal or no. But at least you shouldn't have to be suspecting your colleagues of being a government operative.
Yeah. Now, at this point, I'm going to bring Jim Flynn back here into the mix and find out from you, Jim, if there's anything you want to add along the lines of looking at the historical nature of state infiltration of activist movements. And you're coming at this from sort of a more recent environmentally oriented experience.
Well, I think it the history of some of these arsons fits perfectly with what Ward was talking about. Supposedly, the Earth Liberation Front came to the U.S. In about like 98 or 97 when the Detroit Ranger Station had an arson added on October 28th. I forget the year exactly, but...
And that's Detroit, Oregon.
Yes, Detroit, Oregon. And the words Earth Liberation Front were spray-painted there. Well, to me, that's not necessarily proof that there's this movement here now. You know, this movement from the UK has moved to the US, and that's what all the news stories were about. And also, very interestingly, immediately after that action, the FBI issued a press release, which they rarely ever do. It was the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the FBI issued a press release saying, we are now on the scene to investigate this. And then 2 days later, someone burnt the Oak Ridge Ranger Station, which is in Oregon as well. And if people know the area, it's less than 100 miles away. And this is while the FBI is on the scene. And, you know, and then that same day, now 2 days later after the original Detroit fire, they find a suspicious-looking milk jug on top of the Detroit Ranger Station, which either means they missed it, they'd been in the building for 2 days with this milk jug on top, or someone put it there while the FBI was on the scene. And any reporter, anyone who saw this milk jug, said it was ridiculous, like it wouldn't have burnt anything. It was a milk jug with some wires sticking out of it. And you know, and then you go back to the Oak Ridge Ranger Station fire, and that is not wouldn't have been and isn't a legitimate target for any environmentalist. We had just won a huge victory in the Warner Creek area, And that Ranger Station contained lots of good files, including our own files, about how the Warner Creek area should be protected as a research natural area. So it was very suspicious to us. No one in the environmental movement would have burnt that building. So I think some of these incidents play right into what Ward was saying, as they turned out later to be provocateurs, and certainly not the activists who committed these crimes.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. We're speaking with Ward Churchill, professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, author and activist, and Jim Flynn, former editor of the Earth First Journal, about the recent federal environmental indictments, placing those in a historical context. And we're going to kind of shift gears somewhat more now and talk a little bit about security for activists.
Let me tie into something that Jim just said. Because I'm not fully up to speed on the situation with these 11 indictments. I expect to be shortly, but I'm still finding out new information. And the spraying of the ELF graffiti around a bombing site was one of two things. It was either incredibly stupid, or it was a designed action undertaken by someone other than ELF to point the finger at them. And that takes me back to another fairly famous case, which is the bombing of the Attorney General's house in 1919, Attorney General Palmer, which then serves as the predication for the so-called Palmer raids, through which the anarchist movement in the United States was obliterated virtually in its entirety for a period of time. Now, that bombing of Palmer's house sort of culminated what was called the Great Anarchist Bombing Campaign. And the interesting thing about the campaign was that every time there was a bombing, there was literature scattered about indicating that anarchists had done it. They were propagandizing by, this was the argument that was made, propagandizing by dropping their pamphlets around these bombing scenes. Now, for one thing, the anarchist pamphlets would have had to have survived the blast of the bomb in each case, which is considerably unlikely, leading one to suspect that someone else had come, and certainly the bombers had not returned to the scene of the bombing after the blast in order to scatter literature around, so someone else had to be doing it, logically enough, although that was not how it was played in the press. You get to the bombing of Palmer's house itself. He was conveniently situated with his family on the other side of this rather large house, so there was no real danger to the physical well-being of the Attorney General. When a bomb goes off in the back porch, you have the entire front lawn covered with this litter of anarchist subversive material, pamphlets, in other words. So apparently the bomber stopped off on his way to a street corner to distribute literature to set a bomb at the Attorney General's house, which is exceedingly unlikely. Even more unlikely is the fact that the solo bomber, as they has always been cast, seems to have had two left feet, because whoever it was that set the bomb blew himself up with it, which means, once again, the literature survived the blast, but the bomber did not.
Right, and it's
intact. He was blown to fragments. But the fragments included two left feet, suggesting the whole story was false. Who did this exactly remains a mystery, but the appearance, again, is all provocateurs. A provocateur signature is to leave indication as to who done it at the scene of the crime.
And
the only people who would be able to scatter subversive literature around a bomb site would be the investigating authorities, suggesting it was the investigating authorities who were the perpetrators. So there you have it. It's a repetition of past history in another form. If you know the history, then the signs become apparent immediately.
And it's not a tangent I really want to get on, but a modern example of that would be the passport that was found from one of these supposed September 11th hijackers that survived everything. Just a flimsy little passport. We've all seen them. So I want to bring Jim back in here. And you recently put an article up on Portland Indie Media, if nowhere else. I haven't seen it elsewhere. Talking about activist security culture. Can you share just some basic information that anyone engaging in activism, legal action, illegal action, whatever you're doing, just good basic ground rules that you should know?
Well, yeah, one thing that I'd like to start with is, as you mentioned, legal or other types of action recently under the Patriot Act and other domestic terrorism activities by the government, they have started to list environmental groups as domestic terrorist groups. They've started to label our simplest civil disobedience actions as acts of terrorism and such. So, you don't have to be involved in arson to need security culture. So we just need to get smarter in this country about working together and working in clear resistance to the government, and be not only be proud of that, but also be smart about it. And a few basic tips that have been talked about are, well, number one, as Ward said, you should never do anything major, illegal major type action, unless you've known the person for years and absolutely trust them. And that includes, like, a discussion of philosophy and, really getting to know the other person and know where they're coming from and know where they're going and, what they would do if they were taken into custody. As these recent actions showed, one individual was turned somehow. He has a heroin problem. He was turned somehow, and he started wearing a body wire and going around and collecting information for the FBI. They would wire him up, as the documents show, they would wire him up, and they would get him to contact one of the people that he had allegedly worked with and ask them questions about the day of a certain event. So he wouldn't be asking them about the arson, but he'd say, "Yeah, you remember how the truck broke down that day? Ha ha ha, wasn't that funny?" And then the person would reply saying, "Oh yeah, that truck sucked." So then they would use that and say, "Okay, aha, that person was there that day." So the thing to learn from this is, don't ever talk about an action after it's happened, especially a major arson or some major action like that. Don't ever talk about it again. Never, ever, ever again. Don't talk about it. And if one of you, not even to someone you did the action with, and I think that's a big issue here, is these people, if they're guilty, thought that, okay, well, you're guilty too, so you're not going to talk. Well, that's certainly not the case, as this has shown. One of the people that commits the crime with you may very well, for whatever reasons, years down the road, turn for some reason or get coerced into turning. And so don't even talk about the action to people you've done it with. And if somebody, one of your alleged friends or co-conspirators or past action buddies, starts to raise questions and ask you questions about things related to the action, start to get a little suspicious of that person. And why are they talking about the van now 10 years later and things like that? So I think that's really important as well, is to just be careful. Just never talk about it again. Never, ever. Take that action to the grave with you. That's got to be the code.
Now, things have changed in the past 10 years or so in terms of the prevalence of electronic communications, computers, email, cell phones. I find so many activists who don't know basic cell phone security. For people who don't know, your cell phone is a locating device as long as the battery is connected, even if your phone is off. And it tracks every 30 minutes or so, depending on your provider. Any tips specific to the kind of, for lack of a better phrase, which I hate anyway, the digital age?
Well, that is certainly not my expertise. The thing I could talk about that actually happened, another problem in these cases, is people talking to the police once they were in custody. It really amazes me how some of these people started talking so quickly. And, as anyone who's ever watched television knows, cops lie to get you to talk. They'll step all over your civil rights. They'll lie right out their pie hole to get you to say things. And then they're just there to gather information, which they then turn over to the DA. And to prosecute you. So don't believe it when the cops say that they're going to cut you a better deal, or your buddy has already talked, or they'll go lenient on you or something. Never. In this case, one of the people arrested has spoken with the FBI numerous times without his lawyer present. His lawyer authorized that. That lawyer should have been fired right away. Wow. It appears some of these other lawyers have suggested to their clients that if they talk about other people to get more lenient sentences, those lawyers should be fired. You should never, ever, even all through this process, ever have to talk about another individual. It's one thing for a defendant to possibly plead guilty themselves or admit guilt themselves for what they did. But even that's a little premature at this point, because all the FBI is going on, all the feds have at this point, is testimony from other people. So if everyone down the line had just kept their mouth shut and only talked to their lawyer, there wouldn't have been these last 11 rounds of indictments.
Ward, we got 60 seconds here. Anything you'd like to add regarding activist security?
With regard to the digital thing, assume that everything you're saying on a telephone cell or not, and everything you type into your computer is being said directly to the proper authorities at all times.
Okay.
In other words, don't be running off the mouth and using funny little codes, because they'll crack them or they'll misunderstand them and they'll make a case against you based upon what they think they know rather than what is actually true. So communicate. Don't talk about this stuff, period.
Okay.
Period.
Well, we are out of time. We'll have to leave it there. I've been speaking with Ward Churchill, who works as a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's a longtime activist and author. And Jim Flynn, who's an activist as well and a former editor of the Earth First Journal. We've been discussing the historical context of the recent environmental and animal liberation activist indictments and some information about activist security culture. Thank you very much to both of you for taking some time out of your mornings to join us here on the show.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Andrew.
Take care, you guys.
Bye-bye.
And that's going to do it. I hope you learned something here today. The People Rise Up website, available at kboo.fm. We'll have lots of links related to the content of this here program. I know there's a lot of you out there listening to the MP3 of this. You can contact me at kboo@riseup.net. I love hearing from new listeners or repeat listeners. And I do appreciate you listening. Thank you very much for that.